What's been your experience of the gig economy as a consumer or a worker? Does the flexibility of these working arrangements make up for the lack of protections that other workers enjoy? Tell me about it on the Radio National Facebook page. You can find all the Life Matters content there. Dr. Caleb Goods is a senior lecturer and researcher at the University of Western Australia Business School. Caleb, thanks for coming on board.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Now, in a little while, we'll talk a bit about how nurses are becoming part of the gig economy, but let's start off with some basics. Caleb, how many workers in Australia take part in the gig economy at the moment?
Yeah, it's a tricky one to measure, but there was a survey done last year that found 7.1% of Australians had either participated or sought to participate in the on-demand gig economy in the previous 12 months. So it's a significant number. And then Uber, in its submission, I think, to that Senate inquiry you mentioned before, said they had over 100,000 people who had registered to operate on either their drive, ride sharing, or their food delivery app. So that's obviously, again, a pretty significant number just operating on those platforms.
And they might not be working all the time or long hours, but it's an indication of how strong the interest is, at least.
That's right, yeah.
The Senate Select Committee has been looking at job security in recent times. How different is the gig economy to the existing landscape for workers in Australia? I mean, casualisation has been around for a really long time.
Yeah, so sort of the submission we made to that inquiry, we sort of suggest it's, an extension of some of those existing things that are taking place. So obviously, though, casual, as you said before, in the gig economy, they're classified as independent contractors. And what that means is you don't have any of the minimum standards that are set down through our employment relations system. So minimum wage, superannuation, sick leave, holiday leave, all those sorts of things do not apply to independent contractors. And traditionally, you know, independent contractors were things like tradespeople or, consultants. So people who had high levels of skill, had their own equipment, could demand, you know, a certain level of pay and security through their work. But with the application of that contracting model in the gig economy, we're talking about a lot of workers who don't have high skills are doing things like transport services, as we mentioned before, and they have little capacity to negotiate or demand higher wages and conditions under a contracting model. So that's on the sort of contract classification side of things, and then the way in which the work is organised. So work is organised on demand. So essentially, the worker is generally paid a piece rate. So they're paid for whatever piece of work that they're doing, and it's also driven by customer demand. So you could be working as an Uber driver and be waiting for work, but if no one wants to take a ride or have food delivered, then you don't get paid anything. So, the income insecurity and variability is significantly higher in this sort of work.
And yet a lot of drivers apparently are saying that they love that. The Deliveroo submission said they had an 84% rider satisfaction survey. I mean, you've spoken to a lot of workers as part of your research.
Yep.
How do workers
yep.
view that flexibility as a benefit?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that – so we interviewed food delivery workers, and some of them were on Deliveroo and for Uber Eats and et cetera. And flexibility is the number one attraction for this form of work. You have to counterbalance that. Their next concern was also how the paying conditions of their work. So they were attracted by the flexibility but concerned about their wages and conditions. The other thing, I guess there's some variation across the gig economy. So food delivery is an interesting one because the flexibility, some of the workers talked about how it attracted them, but then they realised that actually it wasn't as flexible as they thought because obviously people are wanting to use that service at meal times, right? So lunch and dinner time. So if you want to earn income, you obviously need to be responding to when customers want the service. So generally they found working at lunchtime and dinner time and obviously weekends was more profitable. So there's no doubt that flexibility is an attractive aspect to the gig economy, and workers certainly expressed that in the research we did as well.
It's interesting too when you look at the wages issue, the CEOs of some of the delivery services have said, yeah, even during peak time, drivers couldn't make the national minimum wage. But then there's what's known as multi-apping, where drivers are working across multiple platforms and trying to boost their wage then. Could people be making minimum wage in that way?
Yeah, there's no doubt that through multi-apping, so, you know, why do people multi-app? It's to try and maximize their earning potential, right? So if you're operating on multiple platforms, you can try and maximize your earnings. So there is the potential that if you're working, you know, across three or four apps, that you might be able to make above the national minimum wage. I guess the challenge is, you know, in thinking about food delivery in our research, is there's only so much food you can deliver within 1 hour, and there's all sorts of challenges around that. So accepting a delivery request, the restaurant hasn't got the food ready, you spend a lot of time sitting waiting, which is obviously unpaid. So yeah, we found that generally riders couldn't do more than two, maybe three deliveries in an hour. So if you're doing two deliveries, on average you make about $10 a delivery. So yeah, even if you're multi-apping, I think it's a real challenge in hitting that national minimum wage.
I was really fascinated to see that Menulog uses a different model in Europe than they use here, and they've decided that they might trial not having independent contractors in Australia. What's driving that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Menulog is an Australian, or was an Australian company established well before the gig economy existed, it has to be said, but it was purchased by a European company a few years ago called Just Eats. And Just Eats, in its European context, is primarily used an employee model, sort of like casual workers, rather than the independent contractor. So, yeah, I think in part they've sort of maybe their parent company might be having some influence in terms of how they operate in Australia. But in their submission and verbal feedback to the inquiry, the CEO talked about a spate of deaths of food delivery riders late last year, particularly in Sydney, and sort of talked about this moral obligation to workers, and this idea that employment is a much better standard to ensure things like occupational health and safety, you know, minimum wages and those sorts of things. So that was their sort of rationale for what was happening. And I think there is a growing kind of community concern, maybe reflecting some of those tragic incidents in the last 12 months, and from consumers, but also obviously the Senate inquiry and other things. I think there is maybe growing momentum around some form of regulation of the gig economy. So I think all of those things coming together might explain the trial that Menulog has said it's going to run.
And as you pointed out, they're not the service that those deaths have occurred employed for. What's been the response from the other services? Have we had a groundswell of support for that idea, or crickets?
No, definitely not a groundswell. I think there is an acknowledgement that that something has to change, I think, from those platforms. But so the platforms I'm thinking of, your Easies, your Deliveroos, Uber Eats, etc., they want to maintain the independent contractor model, essentially, that it's core to how their business functions. And so their argument is that they would like to see regulatory change that allows them to provide certain conditions to their workers without reclassifying them as employees. So they want to stick with the contracting model, but want to make changes to allow them to provide insurance or safety equipment training. Because if a company provides those things, their workforce starts to look more like employees, and they'll be reclassified as such potentially. So that they want to maintain that contractor model. So no, there's not a groundswell for the employee model, that's for sure.
Well, and we wait to see too whether people will be willing to pay more for the knowledge that workers are being treated better. We're speaking with Dr. Caleb Goods, Senior Lecturer and Researcher at UWA Business School, here on Life Matters Today. And I'd love to hear your experiences with the gig economy, whether that's as a consumer or as someone who works in it in whatever sector that's applicable to. Is it worth it? Is the flexibility and the much vaunted usefulness of being able to zip around working when and where you choose worth those payoffs of not having paid leave, not having workers' comp, not having access to those benefits that other workers have? Tell us about it on the Radio National Facebook page. Also with us today is Annie Butler. She's the Federal Secretary of the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation. Annie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Hilary. Pleasure to be here.
Now, this might surprise people to hear that the gig economy model is filtering through to the healthcare sector. Let's start at the ground first and give us a sense of the employment landscape for nurses, whether it's across public and private and in aged care. What's the breakdown of part-time and full-time and casual that people experience?
Okay, so in the public health sector, there tends to be secure, meaningful employment for most of the people working in the sector because there's a very solid industrial relations framework underpinning that work. The majority of our members do work slightly less than full-time hours. The average is about 34 hours per week. When you look at nurses and our membership particularly, you see that the majority are female. The average age is about 42, 43, 44, depending on which sector you're in. And so it varies. Obviously, they've got childcare needs, other things that they have to manage. There is generally relatively stable employment across the private sector in big places, but it starts to vary a lot once you get to the aged care sector, where that's where we see the highest proportion of our membership in casual employment or having to have more than one job. What we see also more predominantly in the aged care sector is an employment model that's been picked up that calls it part-time, permanent part-time, but uses a minimum low hours contract. So that means that the nurse or the personal care worker is contracted for, in some cases, honestly, it's 0 hours, but 4 hours or 16 hours per fortnight. And so that's what they're contracted for. But routinely, they're asked to work more hours because what the employers are doing there then is not offering secure, settled employment, but they allow themselves to use those additional hours almost like they have a casual employee and just flex those hours up and down sort of at their whim based on what they judge as their particular needs at the time. Now, the consequences of that are very difficult for the actual worker, and that is precisely what forces many of these workers to have to work more than one job, is because they can't plan for the future. They don't know what their income will be. Many of them have children. They can't plan for the future for their children or their own economic security, but they also can't just plan for activities that they're trying to engage in as a family. So there's a bit of a variety across the sectors.
And Annie, this select committee inquiry is also looking into the effects of the pandemic. One really interesting thing that happened for a short space of time during the pandemic last year was the federal government drawing on nurses via a platform called Mabel, so an app that helped them access a surge workforce during the aged care crisis. You have some concerns about that. Tell us about them. Is it a bit like Airtasker for nurses? Is that how it worked?
It is a little like Airtasker for nurses. Now, I should just be upfront and declare that the Federation has significant issues with Mabel and other online platforms that are creeping into the health and aged care sectors. We had particular concerns with the use of Mabel during the pandemic because there was a lack of transparency around the deal that we saw done between the federal government and Mabel. They used the emergency, and it was a legitimate health emergency, of course, but they used that they had emergency powers in the immediate health crisis that they didn't need to go out and search more widely through the market. So I just want to be frank that I do have some of those concerns about Mabel. The problem with the online platform is the same as your other guest was saying. The nurses and personal care workers are treated as independent contractors. So exactly all of the same circumstances that Caleb outlined apply to nurses and personal care workers. What we saw in the height of the pandemic, particularly in the second wave in Victoria, was that often the right sorts of staff weren't supplied. So that was the very peak of the health crisis from COVID in the country, and we needed highly skilled, high-level staff to be able to be dealing with what was happening in aged care, and they weren't always supplied. Our problems with Mabel extend beyond just the aged care crisis because all of those employment concerns that have been discussed but also for nurses. And we see that some of the people that we're hearing from our members, personal care workers and nurses who might be attracted by Mabel and those other platforms, it's often to supplement their existing work because they're not getting enough hours. But for nurses, there are a whole range of other matters that are professional matters. They have a professional license. They need to uphold all of the requirements that are put upon them by the regulatory authority. And it's difficult to achieve that when you're not in a secure employment relationship and when you don't have access to, you know, high wages to be able to fund yourself. So you need to access professional development. You also need to have appropriate insurance arrangements in place, and that can be very difficult when you're dealing with a platform like Mabel.
I do have a question for Caleb just before we run out of time, but I want to ask you quickly, Annie, the NDIS uses these online platforms a lot, and a lot of participants in the NDIS really value them because they can directly hire nurses and personal carers and have that personal control of their NDIS budget. Is there a way that we can have it both ways and protect the workers using those platforms but still make sure that NDIS participants have control?
I guess that's a very good question. And we understand, especially in the NDI sector, is where we've seen the biggest rise. And we understand that people want that choice and control over their lives. The important thing to remember from our perspective, though, is that workers deserve to have choice and control over their lives as well. And what we find is that when they don't have good terms and conditions that support them to do their work, care quality often declines. And what we see most often is that a safe, satisfied worker is going to lead most definitely to a safe, satisfied care recipient. So if we can find ways where we can support this, what's known as consumer-directed care, so that the care recipient is satisfied and they do have choice, but also make sure the worker has secure employment, then I think we'll solve the problems.
Annie Butler, Federal Secretary for the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation, here on Life Matters today. Dr. Caleb Good's with us too, Senior Lecturer and Researcher at the University of Western Australia Business School. And we'd love your thoughts too on the gig economy, the pros and cons from your experience, either inside it or as a user. You can head to the Radio National Facebook page and tell us your thoughts. Or send a text, 0418 226 576 is the Life Matters text. Caleb, what do we need to do? What changes could or should be made to ensure that gig economy workers, whatever sector they're in, have more rights, more security?
Yeah, so there's, you know, various options, I think. And the first one, and sort of reflecting what Menulog has announced it wants to do, is to, you can potentially go to an employee model, but they want to create a new modern award. And I don't want to get into the complexities of the award system, but essentially they want to set up an employee model that's fit for purpose for the gig economy. So that might be some changes around minimum time commitments or shifts for workers, minimum paying conditions and those sorts of things. So that's what Menulog is seeking to do. So that's one potential avenue. Another avenue would be to give independent contractors greater security and rights. So, you know, if you're an employee and something's gone wrong, you have the ability to go to the Fair Work Commission or the Fair Work Ombudsman. But as an independent contractor, you don't actually have that right. So you could give the Fair Work Commission and the Fair Work Ombudsman greater powers to have oversight over the gig economy. Or you could set up something similar, but a much more industry-specific approach. So you could set up some kind of board for food delivery or courier delivery services more broadly to ensure that occupational health and safety is provided to workers and insurance, training, set pay and condition standards for that industry. So I think there isn't necessarily one approach you could take, but there's various approaches. So one maintains the contractor model, and one could be going towards a more traditional employee model. So I think those would be the best ways forward.
There's some flexibility in solutions as well. Dr. Caleb Goods, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Caleb Good, Senior Lecturer and Researcher at the University of Western Australia Business School. And you heard too from Annie Butler, the Federal Secretary for the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation. And we're going to see about $10 billion over 4 years in the upcoming budget go into aged care. The ANNF wants mandated staffing ratios. We'll see how that plays out.